For 3 years, Robert Young Pelton has tracked the global reach of the private security industry, traveling from the volcanic island of Equatorial Guinea to the deadly streets of Baghdad, from the tribal areas of Afghanistan to the farmlands of Arkansas, all the while uncovering closely held secrets that will shock most of you. License to Kill in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Robert Young Pelton has become an inspiration for a new generation of intellectual adventurers. He is the author, journalist, filmmaker, photographer, adventurer, explorer, expert, philosopher, a puppet, a poet. Keeps going on and on. He's got a great list of titles. Robert's the executive producer and host of his series of highly rated specials for the Discovery and Travel Channel as well. This book, as I mentioned, License to Kill. Robert, welcome to Coast to Coast. How are you?
How you doing, George?
I should say welcome back. It's been a few years, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think the last time I stayed up this late was right after September 11th. So.
Right around that period. You are right. Tell me a little bit about this one. This is an interesting investigation for you.
Yeah, well, you know, I do my book, World's Most Dangerous Places, and I usually stumble across developments or ideas or things that are happening out there, and early on the war on terror, I was with the Special Forces team, and I was surprised about 6 months later when their guys were working as contractors. And I couldn't figure out what a contractor was, but one of them was Karzai's bodyguard, President Karzai of Afghanistan.
Hey, Robert, we're getting a huge bad line from you right now. I can barely hear you.
Yikes. Hold on here. That sounds like a crackle on the phone.
See what we can do to fix this a little bit, if we're going to be able to or not. The mechanics. When it works, it works. Well, let's go a little bit. If it works, fine. If not, okay. I may have to go to open lines, Robert, and reschedule or try to reconnect. I understand this is your only phone line, right?
Yeah. Well.
Okay.
I actually brought down an old phone just for the show.
So you needed one of the CIA phones or something.
Exactly. Some kind of technology thing.
You have a cell phone, though. We may be able to switch that over.
Yeah, you can call me.
As a matter of fact, let's do this now. Tom, you've got the number. Call his number right now. Call his number, and I may do a dual switch. You have the cell phone next to you?
Yeah.
All right, let's have Tom call it. I'll hear you say hello, and I'm gonna switch you right over.
Okay, great.
And let's see what happens. Just stay on the other line for a little bit. This is a first, folks, worldwide on network radio. We are going to hook up with this. Come on, Tommy, dial the phone number.
You're on the fly.
Yeah, here he is. But in the meantime, when I was reading your book, one of the main questions to me is, why don't we do wars like this all the time, Robert? It's cheaper.
It's cheaper, and it's faster, and it's cleaner, and nobody knows about it. But we used to do it, and then, back in the dirty wars, like White Star in Laos, nobody knew what was going on then. And we had all kinds of contractors and Air America and mercenaries, fighting the communists, and we like that kind of war, but what happened is that got out of control. And you remember the movie Apocalypse Now, and you've probably seen some of those crazier things that people don't quite believe are true. Well, all those things were true, and then the Church Pike Commission shut the CIA down for running wars sort of on the private side.
Tommy says, by the way, he's getting your voicemail.
Okay.
So turn your phone
on. Turn your damn phone on. Hold on.
Turn your phone on, and then Tommy will call you.
Okay.
All right, you got it on now?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Tom. Do it again, and we'll try the old switcheroo.
In any case, fighting wars using proxy armies or privatized people was sort of a 60s, sort of post-Cold War development. And it wasn't until 9/11 that we started doing that all over again. And it's expanded dramatically since we've been in Iraq.
This is beginning to become like the Keystone Cops.
Yeah.
He says, I have a backup number, but it's not the cell.
It's the 917.
Yeah. Do you have a 917 number there, Tom? He doesn't have that number.
Okay. Well, what? I can call in. How about that?
Do you have the hotline number?
What's your hotline?
Oh, I can't give it to you. If I give you the hotline number, 9 million people are going to call. So let's I tell you.
It'll be a wild show.
Let's just chat until the end of the half here, and then we'll all work this out together. Okay.
In any case, it's a new phenomenon that a lot of people don't know about. And so I spent the last 3 years traveling around the world, hanging out with these guys and trying to figure out what they do and the people that own the company.
Are they all ex-military?
Yeah, almost, 99%. There's a couple of guys in the book that you'll meet that are actually not military. One was on President Aristide's detail, and the other one worked for Blackwater on the Bremer detail.
What happened to Aristide? I mean,
he was deposed by his security contractors.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we funneled cash to him to pay for his, how many bodyguards did he have at one time?
Well, he started off with a couple of dozen. So let's say 3 dozen in total with support people. And then he got into trouble, and then he started losing sort of this uprising. And then he thought, well, damn, these guys are good. I'll get some more. And so he put an order in to double his inventory, and the State Department figured that he was going to use them as mercenaries. So they were stopped at the airport, and then the word came down to basically wake Aristide up, take him to the airport, and there'd be a plane waiting for him. And his security guard, which he was paying for, it wasn't the U.S. money, woke him up, told him they were going to a TV station to make an announcement, but they drove him straight to the airport, and then there were a number of men with military uniforms that once they got on the plane, with his security detail and their families, they changed out of their uniforms into civilian clothes. And they said that he landed in somewhere in the Caribbean, but he was actually in Miami. And they sat there on the airport until they could find a country, which happened to be Central African Republic, that would take him. And it was one of those strange things where it's hard to believe that somebody's security, bodyguard would actually take them down, but it happened.
Was he paid off, you think, the bodyguard?
Well, I think what it is basically pressure. The Steel Foundation, which was the company that he had hired, obviously gets a phone call from the State Department, and they're not going to argue.
No, when that call comes in, you basically do what your client tells you to do, right?
Right, and this is basically how they control these companies, because as long as they've got large contracts with the U.S. government, that's their way of sort of steering them left or right.
Is this black ops money, Robert?
Not really. I mean, the business of security is somewhat overt. I mean, if you're running a drill rig in Nigeria, let's say, or Colombia, you just slice off a certain percentage for security. So it's a fairly open...
And you concept. Label it as such? You just say, this is security?
Yeah. The problem is that these guys range anything from Marines to Special Forces to, let's say, Delta SAS, and they have connections within the government. So if something needs to be done, or somebody needs a hand, like in Iraq, they call their old buddies up. So there's a lot of times when people cross the lines.
Now, these are Americans, right?
Yeah. Well, I'll give you an example. I was near Abu Ghraib prison, and one of the guys that runs a large warehouse there is an old Mac VSOG guy. Well, he jumps over the wall, and he snipes guys who try to, when I say guys, Iraqis, who try to mortar their compound. Now, he's not supposed to do that, but he's trained to do that, and he's very good at it. And in essence, he's doing what we're doing, but he's actually a private citizen in a foreign country.
The Americans who are you don't like to use the word mercenary, but that's really what they are.
No, I mean, mercenaries are mercenaries. I have lots of friends who are mercenaries.
Right. What are the chances that, and how many are there? How many are we talking about here?
Well, if you're talking security contractors, there's about 70,000 working in Iraq right now. Probably
70,000, like soldier type guys, private people.
I call them hired guns. They're basically men who are hired to keep people alive.
And they have 70,000. That's all. That's half the troop force.
Exactly, and about half of those are Iraqis, and about half of those are expats. But it's extremely logical when you think that we don't have enough troops over there. So, for example, I was over in Iraq last month, and I was with a security company that we were driving around in armored pickup trucks with the guys with machine guns in the back and steel tubs, and we were guarding gravel. I mean, that's how ridiculous it is in Iraq right now. And that gravel was going to build a police station about 30 miles north of Baghdad, and everybody on this project knew that once that police station was built, it was going to be blown up by a truck bomb. So, I mean, that's just the way things go over there.
Do you think this Iraqi situation is just out of control?
Yeah, it's chaos is the best word. People always say, well, is there a civil war going on? They'd say, well, civil war would mean that there was some kind of logic to what was going on. There's so many different groups and sort of ethnic and religious, segments that are fighting each other that it's almost chaos. When I was over there, the Iraqis were buying Syrian passports to get their families out of the country. So it's evolved into sort of just a free-for-all, like one of those Western movies, where people are smashing chairs over each other's heads.
What's going to be left there, Robert? Realistically, what will be left? Just the oil? Because everyone else will leave.
No, my prediction is the natural homeostasis of Iraq is there's three sections. There's Kurdistan, which is doing just fine. There's not much violence there at all, and they're doing well. There's the central part, which is really more of a swath that goes from Lebanon through Syria and Jordan, and that's sort of the Bedouin sort of belt there. Then the southern part, which is Shia, which can get along just fine with Iran. And then you'll have a separate entity, which is essentially the oil industry, going from Kirkuk south, and that will be run by corporations. And then, of course, they'll pay their taxes or whatever. But the way that that works is very much like Colombia and Nigeria, where as long as you can seize the assets of a country and protect it, we really don't care what goes on with the politics.
You start off your book with an individual who basically his family made money as an automobile supplier, and he takes off, he explodes. What happens? How does he do this? How does he decide, I'm going to run a company and contract out soldiers, basically?
Well, you're talking about Eric Prince,
yeah.
Who's a young guy, he's in his mid-30s. His father was an industrialist in Michigan, and he made his money with the lighted sun visor. And at that time, the American auto industry was just starting to outsource a lot of its products. So, you know, he picked up a lot of stuff from his dad, along with, you know, almost $1 billion in inheritance. And he was in the Navy SEALs, and he thought, you know, that there's a need for training facilities. So he bought 6,000 acres on the east coast of the United States, North Carolina. And for a while, his business just sort of struggled along in the mid-90s. It was basically his personal toy. And then when 9/11 hit, he got his first gig providing security for the CIA over at Shkin and Kabul and Herat. And it wasn't until Iraq hit and they had to keep Bremer alive that all of a sudden his business started to explode. And what he did is he brought over 3 helicopters, armored vehicles, about 60-some-odd, you know, ex-soldiers, and kept Paul Bremer alive.
The cost for these individuals must be how much? We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's got that number. If you want to do some stupid math, you can say, look, there's 18-some-odd billion in Reconstruction, and the GAO, the accounting office, came up with an estimate that somewhere between 15-30% of that money is actually spent on security. So that's an extraordinary number.
It is huge.
And that's not just one nice slice. There's multiple slices. So let's say a dollar goes to Iraq. Well, every time you subcontract, there's a layer of profit, and each one of those subcontractors needs security. So it actually doubles, triples, quadruples up before it gets to the ground.
How many of these guys are getting killed in various forms of combat?
About 400 have been killed in Iraq. And some of those range from the mundane to the actively, you know, fighting. But the bottom line is that the only way people know is when they apply for what they call a Defense Base Act insurance.
This insurance is paid for by whom?
The government. It's provided, if you're working for the U.S. government, it's a way to give people life insurance in a war zone.
Now, you went along with some of these contractors, right? Not journalists. How come?
Well, I'm not a journalist.
No.
I don't ever want to be a journalist when I grow up. I just want to be someone that makes films or does books. And what I do is I hang out. It's a very scientific term for basically walking in their shoes. And my first time with a contractor when I was out looking for bin Laden on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Second time is I spent a month doing Route Irish at its most dangerous, which is it's a 4 to 7 mile run between the airport in Baghdad and the Green Zone. And I was with the Mamba team with Blackwater. And that was a very violent month with about a car bomb every day and all kinds of shootings and attacks, you name it. But you can only learn what these guys do by sort of intense immersion in their world.
Did they trust you?
You know, to some people, I'm kind of a rock star for what I've done. And, you know, they know me through my books and whatever. Other guys, I'm just some geek that shows up and doesn't know which end of an M4 to shoot at. But I think after a while they realize that when things get tight, I'm pretty laid back, and I'm not judgmental, as you can tell from the book. I'm just trying to write down what
you're
happened.
Just laying it out there. I mean, do you walk around with a weapon? I don't think you do. Do you?
Well, I don't like to carry a weapon. I mean, I don't mind traveling with people with weapons, but in this particular case, The logic, as explained to me when I chose not to take a weapon, was that, well, we need an extra weapon, so when you get killed, we might want your weapon. So I would carry a weapon, and I'd be fully...
You were like a mule.
Exactly. Well, they called me the bullet bitch, because I had 8 magazines of M4 ammunition on my chest. So if I went down or somebody needed more rounds or clips, I could hand it to them.
License to kill. That's the story. I guess your phone's kind of holding up a little bit here, Robert.
Yeah,
You know, what we'll do is we'll get Tom to get your cell phone number during the break, just to be on the safe side.
Sure.
And if this cracks, we'll just call it, just keep it on, and you can just flip over to that phone while we're live on the air.
Sure.
What the heck? Let's talk about Bin Laden. Today, Al Jazeera released some old videotape of him walking around with the two of the reported hijackers.
Mm-hmm.
The search for Bin Laden, 5 years old now. We're not getting any closer. We're not going into Pakistan, where I think he is. You think he's there. Why not?
Well, I did an interview back, in 2002 with Salon, and I pointed out that, gee, you know, if you're going to stamp out Islamic fundamentalism, you have to go to the roots of it. And those places are Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, you know, the countries that we call our allies in the war on terror. And one of the funny things is the countries that we had gone to hire jihadis to go kick the Russians' butts all of a sudden became sort of lily white and clean, and that's not the case anymore. And if you understand the whole history of Pakistan and their sort of fight in Kashmir, is that they're the ones that set up that entire sort of jihadi training camp concept. Now, it would make sense that Pakistan would always want an ace in the hole, and Bin Laden definitely is an ace in the hole, because what happens if we lose? And I don't mean lose militarily, but what happens if public opinion just swings towards the Islamic fundamentalist side? Well, most of the people in Pakistan are devout Muslims, and if we screw up what we're trying to do, Bin Laden will be a sort of a hero in their eyes.
So we, at this point, feel as if it's worse public relations-wise there to go in there and get him and to do whatever we need to do to clear out that area to get him.
Well, there's a bigger problem here, and really what happened is that George Bush took a misstep. When we had the attack on 9/11, it seemed to Washington that this was sort of a military action, and you can argue it both ways. But the reality was it was a very small group of people when you consider the global problems we have. But what we did is when we attacked the symbols, in other words, Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and whatever, we polarized a number of other countries that had their own Islamic insurgencies. So now all of a sudden everybody looked to us as the bad guy. When we went into Iraq, we basically convinced every Muslim nation that we were out to get them, that we were essentially crusading. And we couldn't have picked a worse country or a worse reason to attack, because, once again, you know, when you travel in the Islamic world or the Muslim world and you watch television and you talk to people, they're not that dumb. They knew that we had trumped up ideas and that we had invented weapons of mass destruction to depose what was essentially a secular socialist leader.
Well, see, one can argue, because you're absolutely right, Robert. I think what we should have done was what the Israelis did during that Olympic Munich disaster, when they got their own private squad, basically, and went hunting for those terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
We should have done that. But instead, you know, we continue to hear reports that 9/11, whether we knew about it or not, the issue is that we wanted full military involvement. And if you look at what's going on this planet right now, they took that excuse and they haven't stopped with it.
Right. And we tend to create an enemy in our own image, and we wanted Al-Qaeda to be a big international military threat, and it wasn't. It was a bunch of guys, a bunch of basically pissed off expats living in Afghanistan, and we overreacted.
Stay with us. We're going to be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, the After Dark newsletter comes out every month, and you can get 14 issues for the price of 12. It's an incredible story on a massive new weight loss program. Take advantage of this by calling 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Robert Young Pelton with us. We're talking about his work in his book called License to Kill. Okay, let's go back again, if we can, about the search for bin Laden. Robert, I think we agree that, you know, had we hired some mercenaries right after 9/11, we might have taken some of the pain away from what's been going on now.
Well, we actually did hire mercenaries. The Northern Alliance was essentially a proxy army, and but they were a legitimate resistance to the Taliban. We actually had to create what we call an Eastern Alliance around the Tora Bora area. And what happened was, when you hire Afghan mercenaries, you can also hire them the other way. And what happened is that bin Laden paid them more money than we did. So the mistake was not hiring Western mercenaries or Western people on the ground. We had some contractors. Remember in the book, Billy Wah was there looking for bin Laden. But we didn't have enough people to really seal off that area. And we had hired Afghans to try to do that. But, of course, they just looked the other way.
Do you believe he truly was hiding away there at Tora Bora?
Well, he wasn't hiding. I mean, that's one of the myths of the war, that bin Laden hides. I mean, I was down the street from bin Laden in 96. He used to drive up and down the road with his little posse. You know?
What kind of car was he in?
Well, he drives, at that time they were driving Toyota Hiluxes, and he would always be in a Land Cruiser, which is for there it's a luxury car. When he was moving around during the war, he was driving in sort of a yellow taxi, sort of a Toyota-type taxi. And he had the same posse, you know, with Toyota Hilux, which is basically a four-door Toyota pickup truck. And he decided to hoof it over the mountains. When I say hoof it, he rode a horse into a place called Parchinar, which is on the Pakistani side, and
okay,
the Parrot's Peak.
And we could take that area out, couldn't we?
Well, I wasn't planning the war. I was in the war, but I wasn't planning it. But the bottom line is that there were people on the ground. I was with General Dostum, who'd fought in that area and knew that region. And he knew that you don't go into a region and hire the local people to fight a war against somebody who's more powerful from them, because they'll get their butts kicked afterwards.
That's right.
So he offered to send his people in to go get bin Laden. They were Uzbeks, which is a different ethnicity than the Tajiks and the Pashtuns there. But there's two things going on. One is just money. You can buy Afghan warlords. And the second thing is they actually have allegiance to bin Laden, because they remember bin Laden from the 80s when they fought against the Russians.
And he was our friend.
Yeah, well, he was the Saudis' friend. Bin Laden never liked us. I mean, he worked with Abdullah Azzam, basically signing up volunteers that came with Saudi money. He never took any of our money, never worked with the CIA. In my book, there's sort of a funny chapter about my time with an old guy that used to work with bin Laden. And he used to complain that bin Laden only worked on Fridays, and that he would only work for certain fundamentalist groups. And this guy had all these rockets that the Pakistanis gave him to take over to fire against the Russians, but bin Laden wouldn't transport them. So, I mean, those that worked with him have less... they're less impressed with him than we are.
Do you believe, Robert, that bin Laden is truly involved in all of this, or do you think he's just a front man or a patsy for whatever else might be happening?
Well, there are a large number of people who are actively plotting against Western governments, either for criminal or political or ethnic or religious reasons. Bin Laden, I think, rose to prominence because he definitely had the most wealth and he had the most experience inside Afghanistan. In other words, he had a little black book with a lot of sort of old boy network.
Yeah.
He gathered people around him, and he was basically a facilitator. So if some people came to him and said, hey, we got this idea, we can blow up this ship, we can blow up this building, we can do this or that, he would say, okay, well, let me put you in touch with this guy who'll be the middleman, the money guy, like whether it's Mohammed Atta or, Ramzi.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Right. I mean, all these people are basically middlemen that bin Laden said, here, you talk to this guy. And this is all nickel and dime stuff, by the way. The entire 9/11 attack is supposed to cost about $400,000, $500,000, and they actually sent money back before they blew themselves up. So it doesn't take that much to fund a bunch of wacky guys that want to blow something up. But we have focused on that because, obviously, he targeted American facilities, American ships, whatever. But if you actually do what I do, I travel around the world and I look at all these terrorist groups attacking all these other targets, he's not the biggest player by any means.
He's not?
No, Iran has done more to damage the United States in terms of funding attacks. I mean, you remember back when we were in Lebanon, and mm-hmm. they blew up the Marine barracks and they killed the CIA station chief. I mean, that's the real deal. I mean, that's an actual military attack on a country that makes them leave that region. So we always look at bin Laden as the enemy, but when you look at any sort of military victory or any sort of military threat in which he could then occupy an area or destroy a certain amount of equipment, he doesn't really have that power. What we do is what he did to the Russians, they bleed to death. We go into an area that costs us billions of dollars to stay there, and when we lose 2, 3, 4, or 5 troops, you know, every week or 2 weeks, and that saps our morale and drains our bank account.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the amount of money we've spent in Iraq now is absolutely astounding. I remember when George Bush asked for his first $85 billion to get this done, and I knew it was going to go higher, and there seems to be no end in sight.
Well, it's also money that's going back into our pocket. A lot of people forget when we drop a bomb, there's $2,000 gone. Well, that goes, when the new bomb's made, it goes to an American corporation that manufactures that bomb. When we hire Halliburton to basically send Baskin and Robbins ice cream to Baghdad.
For $1 billion.
That's per scoop. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's all money that's going into American pockets. And so it's this bizarre way of sort of borrowing money to inflate the military-industrial complex. So to me, it's fascinating to watch, because when you look at what actually hits the ground, you know, in Iraq, what sticks to the Iraqis' pockets or helps them out, it's very little.
Why didn't we use these mercenaries to take out Saddam Hussein? Why did we have to commit 140,000 troops?
Well, here's the thing. You know, what's new is old again and vice versa. We did. We had one of the most robust CIA operations inside Iraq for 10 years between the two wars. We were training. You remember Bob Bauer and his books, you know?
Yeah.
We were training the Kurds to overthrow Saddam. We were training the Shia to rise up and overthrow Saddam. We did have mercenaries. We did have a very robust intelligence.
What went wrong?
Well, we screwed it up.
Again?
We were infiltrated, and what's even sadder, because I've been to many of the mass graves, we told the Shia in the South that as soon as we attack, you guys rise up and do this and do that back in 91, and we didn't. And they were slaughtered by the thousands, if not the hundreds of thousands.
Oh, my. They almost like they were set up.
Yeah, exactly. And then if you saw what happened to the Kurds, they were forced up into the mountains until we actually had to go there, and I think it was Restore Hope or one of those silly names they gave it. The Kurds were actually forced up into the mountains during the coldest part of the years, and we had to airlift food up there. It was a disaster.
Are we not any good at any of this?
Well, you know, it's like pulling spaghetti versus pushing it. You know, there's a right way to do things and there's a wrong way. When we try to social engineer, it's extremely difficult. I mean, when you try to recreate a non-country like Iraq, which is essentially three governments from the Ottoman era, into a modern democratic society, it can't be done by anyone with any amount of money. If you liberate a country like Afghanistan from the Taliban, it's actually very easy, because we throw off the shackles of a militia that's kind of wacky, and then if we just pour just a little bit of money into their country and then help them train their army, their police, things are fine. But we have virtually no one on the ground in Afghanistan, and it's now going back to the Taliban, which are essentially the Pakistani and Pashtun elements.
Most of that country is, other than, you know, the area around Kabul where Karzai is.
Right, exactly. And the reality of occupation and liberation is, yes, you can liberate a country, but it will always become the most dangerous sort of state, which is a newly emerging democracy, whether it's the Balkans or whether it's Russia. They have to go through that nightmare. There's no way to babysit them so they don't try to kill each other. And then at the end of that, they will form a fairly normal government and get back to business.
Were you in Iraq during the hunt for Uday and Hussein?
Yeah, I was there just before, during. I was there for 3 months during the actual beginning of the war. And I was actually driving one of Uday's cars. I had a red Bentley that I'd bought. And originally I was hired as a journalist by ABC to go cover the war, and I got bored with that. And I just cruised around the country looking for mass graves with a bunch of crazy Arabs.
In Uday's Bentley?
Well, he had about 200 or 300 of them, so it wasn't like his only car.
He had 200 or 300.
Well, you remember they looted Kuwait. They went into Kuwait and stole everything that
they took everything.
Yeah, and this was Uday had a farm in which he had at least 400 vehicles. You know, Ferraris, Rolls Royces, Bentleys, you name it. And of course, as soon as the looting started, everybody just bolted in there. And there are some of the saddest sights, like a Ferrari 328 just smashed by kids because they couldn't figure out how to start it.
And, oh my God!
No, it'd make you cry.
And I'm sure they couldn't repair them.
Well, they're just junk, and there's so many of them, and they're all pre-1989-90 because they're all stolen and looted from Kuwait.
But they were old classics.
Well, exactly. The one I had was beautiful shape. Had gold. The chrome had been tinted gold, and it was bright red, and it was kind of fun, actually.
Crazy. The brothers were insane.
I know. You know, here's the thing I found from experience, and I know lots of evil dictators.
I would say criminally insane.
You got to divide by how much propaganda. I mean, I would have to say Uday was a spoiled brat. You know,
I would agree with that, too.
There's plenty of stories about the horrible things he did and the fact that he used to go to universities and pick out women. And
From some guy, it would be his girlfriend, right?
Right, and then he would shoot some of these gals, and eventually he was shot in the crotch by some jealous guy or some revengeful person. But the point is that he was just your typical rich kid. It seems like the original dictator seems to be like a strong guy, but the kids are just out of control. But here's the funny thing, is that the Iraqis mirrored that in George Bush Sr. and George Bush Jr., because the Iraqis would tell you about George's cocaine days, you know, and the fact that he was wild and crazy and so on and so forth. So they actually saw them as being almost like twins.
Heckle and Jekyll.
Yeah, and the Iraqis all told me, because my car would poop out about every, you know, 100 miles or so, and we'd just push it into the house, and they would always feed us and welcome us, but they'd always give us their version of what was going on in the war. And it was all about the son taking revenge because the father didn't win the first war. And so the son would be more brutal, he would be more sneaky or whatever, and they could cite you chapter and verse about all the dirt on George Bush.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Do you think most Iraqis want us out of there?
Oh, it depends what day you're talking about. Originally, the Iraqis were shocked that they lost the war. You got to understand, they thought they won the first war. They took the fact that we didn't go into Baghdad as being repulsed by Saddam Hussein.
Right.
When they lost this war, first of all, they were shocked. And then they thought, well, wait a second, it's not so bad because, you know, America is like, that's, everybody loves America and democracy and so on and so forth. And there was this magic sort of 2-3 week period. And then the looting started, and they said, well, wait a second. I thought America is this sort of superpower, and they can do anything and so on and so forth. And then within another month, you know, all this, we were making promises. Remember Jay Garner was on TV there saying, you know, we're going to get the electricity working. We're going to do this. We're going to fix the roads.
Get your running water going again.
Yeah. And, of course, none of that
happened.
None
of that happened.
And it still hasn't happened. I mean, there's about as much electricity in Baghdad, actually less than there was during Saddam's reign. The oil production is about the same. Crime is extraordinary. Violence is off the charts.
Somebody's bombed every day now, at least. There's 5, 10, 20 Iraqis.
Well, more than that. That's just what you hear in the news. I mean,
oh my.
Baghdad morgue had over, when I was there in July, they had over 3,000 bodies in the morgue just in Baghdad.
God.
And they don't even cover what goes on outside the city.
So what are we there for, Robert?
Well, here's the thing. Afghanistan I got completely. I thought we had gone a little bit overboard on, oh, the Taliban are evil, we're going to go get them.
But we did have a clear-cut mission.
Yeah, there was no confusion worldwide as to what we were about to do.
And everybody supported it.
Right, and including the Afghans, because I was there when we liberated towns, and people would line up for miles and cheering and throw money, and you know, just it was the happiest thing you've ever seen in your life. When you first turned on a television or you played music, the Afghans went crazy because they were being freed, and it was an amazing feeling and an amazing sight.
So they hated the Taliban that much?
Well, you got to remember, Afghanistan's a big country. The southern part is predominantly Pashtun and very conservative, and the Taliban is more of a tribal influence than a religious influence. A lot of the wacky things that people saw is what they did when they got to Kabul. And Kabul was a very cosmopolitan, Soviet-built city.
Right.
And they hated those city slickers. And those are the places where they whacked all the women because you could see their ankles and so on and so forth. But the Taliban never lost support in the South. because it's essentially a conservative Pashtun movement backed by Pakistan. In the north, and of course the Hazaras in the middle of the country, absolutely hated the Taliban because they killed them by the thousands. So it was much easier to liberate the north, and that's where we started, and then Kabul because they hated the Taliban. But when we got further south, we never actually liberated anything. The Taliban, I mean, if I pointed to a guy and I said, oh, he's a Talib, you'd say, hey, well, he looks like an Afghan. He's got a turban, you know. There were no uniforms. There was no sort of way to identify who was pro-Taliban and who wasn't. So, but the bottom line is when we liberated, there was a wait-and-see approach, and we told the world that we were going to rebuild Afghanistan, which is not that tough, but if you, you know, if you're a Katrina watcher, you know that we can't do much of anything on a big scale in a short period of time. But the people that we went to were more simplistic and more trusting. And they believed us when we said, we're going to pave these roads, we're going to get these things fixed, we're going to build schools and so on and so forth. And so they felt let down. And now you've got most of Afghanistan in the south working on the poppy trade because there's no jobs and there's really nothing to do. You've got the north sort of complaining that they don't get any attention from the mayor of Kabul, as they call him, Karzai. And you've got sort of an increasing amount of violence every single day there.
Well, the phone's starting to crackle again on us, Robert, so we'll try to make the switch at the top of the hour. And, you know, if it breaks, I'll keep you for another hour. We're going to take phone calls with you next hour.
Sure.
And get into this. But, you know, the overall approach to this is, you know, I think my take is just listening to you is, you think that some of these battles should be fought with just private type soldiers.
Correct.
Instead of, you know, bringing in a full military, they probably would be more efficient, wouldn't they?
Well, if you ever listen to Mike Shore, who was the head of the bin Laden unit, he tracked bin Laden for years and knew where he was all the time. And they had trained up a group of mercenaries, if you want to call them that, to go in and take him out. And repeatedly, that request was turned down. And had that happened, nobody would even have wondered about who bin Laden was or where we lived. It was after September 11th that we forgot that we already had this mechanism in place. You know, we had people. I mean, for example, Mike Spann, the fellow that was killed in Kalajangi, actually flew in to take out bin Laden and was told to stand down.
Jeez. Doesn't make any sense.
Well, once again, it's if I was to have somebody do something for me, the government would be the last person I would ask to do that. I mean, and what you're seeing is that when we move quickly and efficiently and we let people make decisions in the field, things usually turn out well. When we overlay a bureaucracy and a political agenda,
it's a disaster.
Exactly.
What are the real possibilities that bin Laden or someone like him will get a nuke and try to use it in this country?
Remote. Because, number one, there's far too much emphasis on nuclear weapons as being sort of the most horrible thing that could happen to us. Number two, it's a high level of technology. I mean, for years we've been tracking the bits and pieces that go into weapons. And thirdly, it wouldn't have the impact that he wants. I mean, bin Laden has one thing going for him. He knows what scares people. I mean, planes crashing, subways blowing up. I mean, these are things that we understand.
It's dramatic.
Yeah.
All right, stay with us. Robert Young Pelton, our guest, will open up the phone lines and give you an opportunity to talk with him. We'll be back.